This is Dissecting Dragons, a speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers.
Welcome to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers. I'm Madeleine Vaughan.
And I'm Jules Ironside. This week, Maynard's Black Magic and Demon Drink, Addictions in Speculative Fiction.
So I think the idea for this episode was basically with the fact that I finally caught up and have read Six of Crows.
Yep.
Which Jules suggested to me quite some time ago.
When you were up to your eyes in coursework.
I was up to my eyes in coursework. And I was doing a lot of marking. And I was like, whatever. And then I finally picked it up. And I loved it. And one of the things I particularly liked about it was the way that they looked at addiction.
Yeah, for anyone who doesn't know, Six of Crows and it's part of a duology, Six of Crows and Crooked Kingdom, they're by Leigh Bardugo, and it's sort of set in a quasi-fantasy Russia, and it's about six basically underworld-type criminals who form, you know, it's like Ocean's 11, but there's six of them and there's magic.
Yep.
I think is a short way of saying it. And it is very, very good. You don't have to have read the other Grisha books. The Grisha are a particular type of magic wielder in that universe. They are quite good, but personally I think Six of Crows and Crooked Kingdom are much better books.
There you go then.
of the two, it's just her style's obviously matured and they are really good. And as you say, they look at a couple of forms of addiction. They've been lauded for, you know, their representation of diversity and, you know, their sympathetic portrayal of disability and things like that. So there's lots good about the books, and they're good stories in themselves. But the addiction's something interesting, because in young adult fiction, particularly, it's not usually presented as sympathetically, I don't think. It's a case of, oh, this is something you did, and we feel sorry for you, but, you know, you made the mistake in the first place. And it has to be a long, hard road kind of thing.
Yeah, and actually, oddly enough, it's tends to be a very particular kind of addiction that you see. And I think before we get on to Six of Crows, which we'll talk about in more detail, I'd like to talk about one of the most common forms of addiction that you end up seeing in a lot of probably YA, and that's the addiction to blood, and that usually comes with sort of vampire fiction.
And it's a bit of a strange one, really, because with it being an addiction to blood, it's not necessarily just an addiction, because if they've become vampiric, then they are basically, you know, that's a necessity. That's like saying you're addicted to being able to breathe.
Yeah.
It's something you need.
I mean, I am quite addicted to breathing, I'm not going to lie.
Yeah, I don't think I'm going to be giving that up anytime soon. But no, there is that sort of sense with blood in a lot of vampire fiction that it's not just, it's oxygen, it's sex, it's drugs, it's food, it's every nice thing you've ever wanted and everything you probably shouldn't want, all rolled into one.
Except for the oxygen part.
I've actually read books before where they actually need blood in order to be able to carry oxygen.
Oh, right. But so, I do recommend oxygen in general for people. Sorry. Moving on
from there.
So yeah, it's a very, very common thing that we see in a lot of kind of fiction. And it comes with this the moral dilemma of, should I drink blood? Is it right to drink blood? Is it right to drink people's blood? Am I going to hell? Do I have a soul? Etc, etc, etc.
And, you know, if you can feed without killing somebody, then you're either stealing or you're taking from a willing donor, and there's always the chance you might just cross that line a little bit too far and wake up euphoric with a corpse at your feet.
Yeah. Which no one really wants.
No one wants, you know, it's probably a good Saturday night out, but you just can't keep doing it. that's a joke, obviously.
Better well be. I'm concerned. So, So it's never really portrayed in a very, very sympathetic way. And it is always portrayed a little bit more as a choice. And it's often portrayed in a very kind of... I think what's interesting is the way they show that I just can't control myself, you know?
Yeah.
And that I just can't control myself. You never really, really sort of... It's never really shown in a very sympathetic way. You think, oh, well, you know, actually, if you really wanted to, you could control yourself. Do you? You always kind of feel that, don't you? You never even think... Whenever anyone does something, then they're about to do something, and you're just there, like, you as a reader or as a watcher, sit there and you can pinpoint the exact moment where you need to start going, no, stop! Whereas addiction can happen in very quiet ways.
Yeah. Yeah, it absolutely can. And obviously the point of it being addiction is that whatever that particular, whatever your drug of choice, and I use the word drug very loosely there because it can be food, it can be drink, it can be anything. It can be buying lottery tickets, it can be doing something else. Whatever it is, it fills some void in you that just isn't filled in some other way.
Yeah.
So it's far more than just being a sort of narcotic rush or something that affects your brain to produce the reward chemicals.
Yeah. So looking at examples of, in particular examples of where you've got cases of addiction, which are main plot points, I think I'm probably going to start with Being Human.
Yeah.
Did you ever watch that?
I think I've watched both versions of it, actually. I may not have seen the last season of the British one.
Yeah. Being Human was originally an English show about a ghost, a werewolf, and a vampire who were flatmates, which I think is a fantastic premise.
Yes.
They were flatmates, and they were just basically trying to live normal lives, and they thought that if they were together, they might have a better chance because they could all help each other out.
Yeah.
And it had Aidan Turner in it. Anyone knows Aidan Turner? He now plays Poldark. And he played Killy in The Hobbit. And the American series came out afterwards, and they actually named the vampire character Aidan after the actor, because they really liked his performance a lot. And yeah, again, the same premise, werewolf and a ghost and a vampire are all living together. And of course, it doesn't really go as planned. And one of the things in that is that... actually, vampires don't need to drink blood in order to survive.
Yeah,
they can go without.
Unfortunately, that was my first stumbling block. Yeah, they can go without, but what are they having instead? Because otherwise, it's just a case of, well, you've traded up on the food chain, but, you know, what position do you fill?
Well, I think they still need to actually eat food.
You never see it, though, do you?
I swear you do.
Well, you know, you see them with cups of tea and things like that, which, you know, the British one you'd expect. But
yeah.
But in all fairness,
you see it in the American one. You see it in the American one. Yeah. He goes and has a meal, and then garlic is a thing, apparently, in the American one, and it wasn't in the UK one.
Yeah, well, it's never really properly explained, so that was a bit of a stumbling block for me.
I see. But I kind of found it interesting, because then it made the whole blood drinking thing a choice. And a different kind of dilemma, because there were situations where they were stronger if they drank blood, and it was a very kind of an instinct within them. And there were situations where people would willingly give themselves. But the way that it was treated and the way that when they drank blood and they were trying to come off of it, it was dealt with like an addiction.
Yeah, it certainly was. And you know, there was other bits, certainly with the British one, where blood drinking was all tied up with sex as well, so it's almost like you couldn't like go out and find someone for a good time and then not end up biting them.
Yeah, there was the connection between the two. It was a sensual kind of thing as well. I'm pretty sure the vampires would bite each other as well.
Yeah, there was that.
So yeah, and that was done interesting. And again, they showed the withdrawal and the very ugly side of withdrawal.
There's a book called The Radleys by Matt Haig. Matt Haig's more of a literary writer, but he writes, weirdly enough, he writes quite a lot of stuff that is sort of speculative as well. The Radleys are a family of vampires who were trying to live a normal life. The two you know, the vampires are pretty rare. They're not out, as it were, so people don't know about them. They can go out in daylight, but they're quite sensitive to the sun. And what these two vampires who've got married and they've had children have done is they've not told their children that they're vampires.
Oh.
So they don't drink blood, but them not drinking blood makes them quite weak and makes them more susceptible to other things. It's always a constant temptation. And you come in at the point where the two children are just starting to go through puberty, which is when they really start needing things like blood. And they don't know where this strange craving is coming from. And just to go even further, the teenage girl of the two children is now trying to be a vegetarian. So she's, you know, she's even taking meat out of her diet, not understanding that really that's the only thing keeping her sane and stopping her from going on a complete killing spree.
Right.
It's really interestingly well done, and they find some sort of balance by the end of it. There's a hint of it being treated more like an addiction, or rather certainly giving in to a set of behaviours that, you know, the downside of drinking blood is it makes you less human. It makes you less compassionate. It makes you less invested in looking after each other. Basically, the teenage girl goes out with some friends for a party one night, tells her mum and dad that she's just had a sleepover. Being a teenage girl, this sort of thing does happen. And she's at the party. There's a bonfire. They're out in a field. They're having a good time. And a boy she likes comes up to her. And she agrees to go for a bit of a walk around the field with him, not realising he's a complete dick. He attempts to sexually assault her, which doesn't go very well for him. I wouldn't normally be laughing, but that there isn't an awful lot left of him by the end of that scene. But nobody can understand how a girl who's that small could possibly have done anything. And she doesn't remember it herself. She does it in this sort of fugue state because he's attacked her and threatened her. All her latent vampire instincts have kicked in, and she's just ripped into him. He survives, just. But he's not quite the same again.
And I'm guessing he's pretty terrified of her from then on.
In fact, I think all the boys are. You know, her social life really takes a dive that day. But this is where the problem comes in, because they end up calling up the husband's brother, who, you know, is a dyed-in-the-wool, I-will-drink-whatever-I-like vampire, to come and do a bit of clean-up. And it's not a great idea, because he's very difficult to get rid of. He's like the relative you do not want to come and stay at Christmas. So it's very funny, it's quite dark, it's very witty, and they come to some sort of balance at the end. But it's looking at things like choosing extreme forms of life that actually don't suit you, and you're not balanced. Basically, you're not looking at looking after yourself and looking after your children. So that was a very good one as well.
That is an interesting one. I read, and for the life of me I cannot remember what it's called, but I read a manga a while ago which is about a vampire family, and they have to drink blood to survive, but what it is that every time they drink blood they tend to have this sort of a thirst for particular kinds of people. So one of them likes people who have a lot of pride, and if they drink the blood of someone who has a lot of pride, that person will, for a short time, lose their pride.
Okay.
Etc., etc., etc. And then this thing happens that their daughter actually is a kind of an anti-vampire, whereby she doesn't drink blood, she gives blood instead. So, she creates surplus blood, and so she bites people, and she ends up giving them blood instead. And she bites people who are unhappy. And when she does, they end up being happy for a short while until the kind of the blood runs off. But they become more productive, they can kind of get on with their lives, you know. And it's a really interesting concept, because it erases this whole other thing, which is they kind of need to drink, and they don't really kill people. So they need to drink blood. They don't really kill people. People don't really remember what's happened. But what it does happen is that it affects them in an emotional way. And that was really interesting. And it was the dilemma of, am I allowed to change the way people feel, even if it is positive? Is that okay?
Yeah.
So I really, really liked that. And yeah, it was the first time I'd kind of seen vampires done in that sort of way. Yeah, but again, the thing is that if she doesn't do it, she does die, or she will kind of collapse. So
it's a bit like the World of Darkness Vampire the Masquerade books, and it's a role-playing game, which I've never actually indulged in, but I rather like the mythology.
Mm-hmm.
And basically, different vampires have to feed on different types of people. So depending on which clan you're adopted into, it will dictate what sort of people you have to feed on. Like, for example, you have the Ventru, who, you know, have very, very blue blood type palates.
Yeah.
And they literally cannot feed on other people. And once vampires have advanced to a certain point, they can only feed on other vampires. So, you know, if they live long enough to get to become sort of elders and beyond that, they become very, very different. They're so divorced from their own humanity by that point that they all they can do is feed off of each other.
That's... wow. So they can only feed off other vampires?
The ones, once they've aged to a certain point, because they get more powerful as they get older. So once they've got past about 500 years old and start heading off towards 1,000, you get these isolated vampires that can literally only go around and feed on other vampires, you know. Humans, the blood would be too weak.
In some
cases, it actually makes them ill. Which is why, once it gets to a certain point, vampires become self-regulating and start killing each other because they don't want to get eaten.
They're like, right, you've lived long enough. Off you go.
And it is something that Anne Rice touches on in Queen of the Damned, with Akasha, who is the first vampire, the queen, the female.
Yeah.
And all vampires spring from her, so she cannot completely die, but at the same time, she's far too dangerous. She's like the uber psychopath. She cares about nothing except destruction. And, you know, since she's so powerful, she can basically make parts of her bloodline burst into flames. So lesser vampires, she can look at them and they just go up in flames.
That's a bit harsh.
Well, she doesn't care, you know. They might be her children, but she, you know, not her friends kind of thing.
And wow.
You can tell when she's had a feeding spree, because there are corpses from here to Kingdom Come.
Right.
So, yeah, bad stuff. That's not addiction, though. That's somebody who's gone so far through the dark creases of their own soul that they're no longer the same person and they're not coming back from that journey.
Yeah. But then again, is it that... I mean, talking about addiction then, is that kind of... It is interesting because the moral message is always that if you give in to these things... you become someone without a soul.
You lose yourself, effectively. And that's perhaps a little simplistic, but it's also, as somebody who's worked with quite a few addicts over the years, there is an element of truth to that. Part of the problem is when people start getting caught up in an addiction, first of all, they don't recognise it as an addiction. And then perhaps they do start to get a recognition that it's an addiction, and what they then do is cover it up because they don't want anyone taking their supply away. And then when they finally get to a point where it's a case of, no, this is actually really damaging me, they're so full of shame they can't ask for help.
Yeah.
Certainly we had this, well, we did a study, but male heroin addicts will usually use heroin for 13 years before they even think about quitting. So that's right at the very, very beginning when they realise there is a problem. That's 13 years of drug use. Alcoholics, you have to work pretty hard to become an alcoholic to get your body accustomed to receiving that amount of alcohol, because alcohol is poison.
Yeah.
But once you've got there, it's very difficult to get out of it. And I'm not going to point or name names or anything, but I do know some people who do have alcohol problems. And I hate using the word pity, but there isn't another word for it, because there's just something missing for them.
Yeah.
I don't know. In some ways, there's a taboo around addictions, like there is around certain chronic diseases, that people don't want to look at too closely, because nobody wants to believe it could be them under the right circumstances. And maybe it would be harder for somebody else to get into those dire straits in the first place. But yet, maybe it wouldn't. Maybe if you had the same set of stimuli in your life leading up to that point, maybe you'd go down the same road. There is obviously a genetic predisposition to some addictions as well.
Yeah. But, yeah, I think it's as you say, the reason why addiction is looked at is that people do realise that that could be them. And some of the best portrayals of addiction are the ones where it says, yeah, this could be you. This genuinely could be you.
Yeah. And one thing perhaps we should just talk around a little bit is writers and addiction. Okay, so not addiction perhaps in speculative fiction itself, but the addiction's happening outside with the writer. There used to be a very romantic notion that drug use would actually expand your mind. And I'm not talking psychedelics here, I'm talking about things like cocaine and heroin, morphine, bad stuff. I'm not saying psychedelics are good, or I'm not endorsing anyone using them, by the way. But basically, that somehow it will let you access a level that you can't access in any other way. Now, if you've ever read Stephen King's book On Writing, where he talks very frankly about his alcoholism, his addiction to cocaine, and various other things, he says that, you know, it didn't stop him writing. He wrote many, many books during that period. It got to a point where both his health and his marriage and his life were basically at risk, and his family had an intervention and sort of wheedled and pleaded and got round it. But in the end, he quit everything and he did go sober on all counts. But it was really difficult. But he says, looking back now, it's horrible because there are books he wrote that he can't actually really remember writing. And he wishes he could go back and do it again because he doesn't remember writing those books. And he likes the books, he just can't remember the creative process. So in using alcohol and drugs as a recreational thing, he divorced himself from the very creative process that he was enjoying in the first place.
Yeah.
But he also said that he realised he was an alcoholic on the day he went to get a beer, and then realised that the six-pack that was in the fridge wasn't there, so he opened another six-pack, went to put the can in the recycling, and the recycling was full, and he thought, oh my God, that was only empty 2 days ago. It's like, I've got an alcohol problem. And what his immediate thought after that was, I need to make sure no one finds out. And that is the process with an addiction, is your first thought is, I must make sure no one finds out that this is a problem.
Yeah.
It's to actually, if you like, pretend the source. Yeah. And then just as a little aside, I don't remember the poem terribly well. It's Samuel Taylor Coleridge, Kubla Khan. Which was written while Samuel Taylor Coleridge was doing great big piles of opium and basically produced this really long famous epic poem, which is a bit bonkers, to be quite honest.
I don't remember you don't remember the poem?
I'm afraid I don't remember it. I had to learn some of it at school, which when you think about it is probably not very appropriate. It hasn't stayed with me, that one.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of good things there. You know, it would be a lie to deny that there has been some incredible art that has been written under the influence.
Yeah.
But there is this marriage between artistry and specifically alcohol, but also, yeah, drugs, which is very sad. And, you know, I've had a few people who kind of were surprised that I didn't really drink. That I didn't do drugs, that I didn't do anything like that. And they were like, oh, but can you imagine what you'd tap into if you did? And I'm like, I don't need to. And like, you could find something brilliant within yourself if you were really high. And I'm just there like, to be honest, I can get myself into a euphoric state with a good piece of music.
Yeah, I know exactly what you mean. Obviously, I've mentioned the epilepsy before, and it's a specific type. So it's temporal lobe. So the part of the really, really old part of my brain misfires. Mm-hmm. And basically, my brain very occasionally decides to basically drop LSD without my permission. That is the net effect of what happens. So I haven't had a seizure for a very long time. But that's what happens to me during a seizure. My brain decides to do LSD. So I do get the whole psychedelic visions and things. I don't need anything to help me. And by the way, it really, really sucks when you don't do it on purpose.
Yeah.
But yeah, you don't need necessarily a substance to help you tap into anything like that.
No.
In my opinion and from my experience, you don't. And, you know, smoking opium pipes is just not done anymore. So.
Don't know what clubs you're going to, but I see people smoking opium pipes all the time.
Are you there in velvet smoking jackets as well?
Yeah, of course.
Caterpillars with hookahs.
But yeah, so that's, yes, it's an unfortunate assumption about writers, which yeah. I wouldn't mind kind of dispelling, because there was almost this encouragement, oh, you're a writer, you should be doing this, you know?
Yeah, where even like, mind.
Yeah, even I just thought, am I really never going to tap into my true potential because I don't like alcohol? You know, and that's a very stupid thing to think, but it's not an unreasonable thing to think. If you're constantly surrounded by this, the best you is you on drugs, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And to be honest, that's not necessarily to say anything against people who, in a controlled and sensible fashion, decide to use certain substances recreationally, because, you know what, that's none of my business.
Yeah, it's really none of my business either. Do what you want.
But I just, it isn't perhaps the most effective way to tap into a stream of creativity.
No.
Although reading things that people have written having had LSD and salvia divinorum trips is extremely enlightening. We'll say that.
That's true.
And peyote. Peyote's the other one, isn't it?
Which one?
It's like a cactusy type root.
I've never heard of it.
Well, it would be quite difficult to get in Britain since we don't have a lot of desert.
Don't we?
No.
Oh.
I mean, it feels like it today, but...
I honestly hadn't noticed that we didn't have any desert here, she said sarcastically. But yeah, so it is true that there has been some incredible, rather informative, very strange, very unique art that has come out of opium-addled mind, and LSD in particular, creates all sorts of odd things. And who knows what the future of drug taking will be. But I guess the point we're trying to make is that it comes with a great cost. And there's almost this kind of assumption that artists die young because actually that's just what we do. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, well, it's inevitable.
It's part of the whole starving artist myth.
It's yeah.
Like, you know what, it's bloody hard to create art or to write if you're physically really hungry and you're worried about your roof caving in. So, you know, that all this whole sort of, oh, yeah, I defy money, I don't need it kind of thing. That's, I'm afraid that's bollocks.
Yeah, the whole you should just do it for the love of it. Like, no.
it's not selling out to want to be paid for your hard work, just as a little aside.
So yes,
yeah, we would recommend that you don't indulge in opium and laudanum and substances of that kind.
Yeah, especially, and if you are going to do that, don't do it because you feel like you have to in order to be validated as an artist.
Yeah, I mean, I can't believe that we're actually having to say that, but it is a lingering myth.
Yeah, that remains.
Going back to speculative fiction, something that does come up in sort of, well, certainly sci-fi fantasy television series, is the addiction to power. And I think that might be because that's quite a good one for them to explore, is, you know, without being too controversial, they still get to go down the route of really looking at addiction, what it does to people and how it changes you.
Yeah.
So, obviously, Buffy the Vampire Slayer, in season 6, you have Willow, who's completely doing far too much magic and really takes it about as far as she can go without destroying everything. And then
yeah.
Supernatural, when Dean gets the mark of Cain, I would have said there is actually an element of addiction to that.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. And actually, the most common thing with the addiction to power is that this sudden belief that one is invincible.
Yeah.
which isn't necessarily incorrect. There are people alive today who are rich, powerful, and really don't understand consequences because they don't, because they genuinely believe they're above it all.
Yeah.
We're not going to name any names, but...
No, there definitely are people like that, and that would be our real-life type correspondence, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
But when you get to the point where it's the same with any type of addiction. When it takes you to the point where you can no longer recognise yourself as being part of humanity, if you like, then that's when it's become a real problem, because certainly in the case of power, you could start to think that because you can order things a certain way, then things should be ordered your way without question, without examining your motives.
Yeah.
Without taking on board anyone else's perspective. That's particularly insidious with power. You believe the world should be ordered your way, therefore you'll make it that way.
Yeah.
I think we have quite enough politicians in the world who genuinely believe that we don't need any more people.
Yeah. So it is an interesting one, the whole addiction to power.
And looking at it a slightly different way, if we take True Blood and the introduction of the main ads, obviously the main ads, as they're shown in True Blood, aren't quite like main ads in Greek mythology. Main ads were a group of women who followed the worship of the cult of Dionysus, and were known for getting extremely drunk, sort of tearing their hair and clothes, and basically pulling men to pieces.
Yep.
So it was a cult that was about, it was about excess. The whole point of the cult was to just let go, to not have control over anything. So at the complete opposite end to the normal addiction to power, you've got an addiction to power whereby it's abdicating all responsibility. And I suppose in a very sort of repressive Greek society, see why that might have been appealing.
Yes.
But when you actually saw it portrayed in True Blood, there was something really hideous about the whole thing.
Because there was a whole sort of play, you know, the Bacchae, about it. And it was a commentary on women and sort of women being able to be unrestrained.
Yeah.
And so in many ways, it was an addiction to freedom, which then meant the complete loss of sense.
Yes.
And what eventually happens is that you have Pentheus, who's the king, Dionysus, or Bacchus's cousin. And Pentheus, who's curious to see what's going on with the Bacchae, goes up onto the mountain and gets torn apart by his own mother.
Yeah.
And again, we go into addiction and how one of the things that happens is that many addicts who are not able to get the help that they need, who are very, very unwell, start making sacrifices that affect their family. And it's not out of a lack of love. You know, it's not that they don't love their family. It's that they, as far as they know it, they need to do it. It's not a thing of choice. It's that I need to do this. I need to gamble our pension because don't worry, I'll get it back.
Yes, or I need to have that drink. I can't function without it.
Yeah.
And the problem is addiction is a stacking system. So you might start off thinking, I need to have a drink every evening. But if you're not a bit moderate in your approach, you might start thinking, well, I need to have 4 drinks. And then it might be, I need a drink first thing when I get up in the morning.
Yeah.
And that's what I mean when it becomes a stacking system. And it's not for everybody, because some people can have a glass of wine every night and that's it, they're fine.
Yeah.
And I have to say, I've met an awful lot of functional heroin users. As in, they literally use it recreationally on a weekend and they hold down 9-to-5, quite smart company office jobs the rest of the time. You wouldn't know they were heroin users. You just wouldn't. You've probably met them and you genuinely don't know that's what they do. I met them because something went wrong and they ended up in accident and emergency.
Right.
So they're not proper, they're not really addicts in the same way. It's something that they need to do and want to do recreationally, but the stacking system isn't in place. So this, I think part of the problem with addictions is that we need to get rid of information that says, well, you know, there are certain things, if you touch that, that's it, you'll be an addict. It's a case of, well, no, you might not be, but is it really worth the risk?
Yeah.
Interestingly enough, I recently watched the second Trainspotting film, the new one.
Yes, tell me about that, because I don't have the courage to watch it.
It's really good. I mean, obviously, Irvin Welsh, extremely good writer. And I do actually quite like the first film, although I remember when the first film came out, and it was like the most shocking thing ever, until Pulp Fiction came out. And it's looking back, I watched that recently so that we could watch the two films, and basically it's not that bad, really. I don't know if it's just a case of times have moved on and you get desensitised, or whether it's because since the film came out, because obviously I was a teenager at the time, since the film came out, I've met real life heroin addicts, as in people who literally live on the street because they can't afford to live anywhere else because they're that addicted to heroin. And, you know, it's not a pretty sight, but they're still people.
Yeah.
I always used to find, when I worked night shifts in accidents and emergency, the people who'd give me trouble were the drunks. Not, and I don't mean the alcoholics, I just mean genuinely people who'd been out on the razz. They were quite violent, I had to throw them out a lot of the time. Heroin addicts who needed to come in were just generally very nice people, which just doesn't fit. This is where all the myths come in, I think. But anyway, going back to Trainspotting 2, there was less focus on drug use, although one character is still very much deep in the clutches of heroin, and it was very sad and quite poignant, actually, I think. What that film really said to me was that 20 years on, all of them were still making the same mistakes. All of them knew they were still making the same mistakes. They just couldn't seem to stop themselves.
Yeah.
No matter what they thought they were doing, they weren't choosing life, not really.
Yeah.
But it's a very good film. I highly recommend it. And I don't think it's quite as gross as, say, the first one. You're not going to watch it, are you?
No. I know someone who gets really uncomfortable with kind of drug-related anything that comes up in a story. And I guess it can be totally misrepresented. But anyway, we're not going to go into drugs because we are talking specifically about addiction today. Yeah. So I do want to talk a little bit about Six of Crows now.
Yeah, definitely. And a good one to compare that to when we get there is a book by Holly Black called Valiant.
Right. So, Six of Crows, you have the premise is that there is this drug, this performance-enhancing drug, which gives people, the Grisha, who are the magical people, it kind of makes their powers go insanely strong.
Yeah.
But it's highly addictive, and it does kill them.
Yeah, basically, that, you know, the withdrawal alone could kill them.
Yeah. So they basically can become slaves to anyone who's got this drug because they are absolutely desperate to keep a hold of it. You know, they have to get it, otherwise they will die. And then there's another addiction which is represented, which is gambling.
Yeah, that's one that people don't really talk about so much, but it is really bad because it does trips the pleasure centres in the brain that makes you do really stupid stuff because you're basically... your brain's telling you to do this because it will give you a reward. It will give you that high of chemicals.
Yeah. Now, it is interesting because ultimately one person's gambling addiction doesn't lead to sort of the end of all times, but it does lead to a situation at the end of the book. And I really like the way it was done because I agree, you don't often see gambling represented as an addiction. But it is, and it's a devastating addiction which affects a lot of people. So it was really interesting to see that. But the thing I liked is that, without giving any spoilers on character, there is a character who basically does have a gambling problem. And they end up doing something a little bit crazy in order to get the money back. And that's and they're in debt to pretty much every gang in the whole city.
Yeah.
But the reason they want to get the money back... is because they borrowed money from their parents.
Yeah, that, under false pretenses as well, it really broke my heart, that bit, because he had such a good relationship with his father.
Yeah, exactly. And that was the thing. It was interesting because
more often than not, when you see the whole gambling thing, the first people who kind of get really affected are the family.
Yeah.
You know, the first people you go to money for are the family, and then you start going to the dangerous people. Whereas it was the other way around. He was in debt to all of these horrifically dangerous people from the get-go.
Yeah.
And then finally, in an act of desperation, he borrowed money from his father. And I liked that. So I don't like it. But, you know, I thought that that was a really interesting way of doing it.
Yeah. I mean, just for clarity, that there's a risk that his father is going to lose the business that he spent his entire life building up because of this.
So
yeah, it's a high-stakes game.
It is a very high-stakes game. So gambling is represented in that, and the addiction to gambling. And again, I liked because it wasn't done in a very overdramatic way. I really believed it. And the character, you see from his point of view several times. And it's very stated very early on that this is a guy who really, really does like the cards table.
Yeah.
And that he's also terrible at betting. But it's kind of treated as a joke. And it's only as it kind of goes on that you suddenly realise, hold on a second, this isn't just someone who likes to, you know, gamble every now and again. This is someone who actually has a genuine serious problem.
Yeah.
And I like the way that it was introduced in that, because he was a high-functioning person.
Yeah.
He was someone you could meet any day. I mean, he wasn't. He was a sharpshooter and stuff. But as a character, he was someone that you could know.
Yeah, definitely. And he was such a likeable character as well.
He was a very likeable character. He wasn't the kind of the simpering sort of shaking. When you picture addiction, you picture kind of withdrawal, don't you? You picture desperate acts. You picture people doing stupid, very stupid things.
Yeah.
And that's not the image he had at all. And that's not the image that a lot of addicts, especially, you know, addicts who are doing it in secret, have. And that's one of the main problems. We don't recognize addiction because we're taught to perceive addiction in a very specific way.
Yeah.
So we don't see high-functioning people and think, you're an addict.
Yeah.
So yes, that I really liked how they did that in Six of Crows. And I would always go to say that Kaz Brekker has a bit of a thing about control.
Yeah, he does. You'll get a bit more of that in Crooked Kingdom. I obviously don't want to spoilify you. But
yeah, he is a bit of a thing about control and sort of being in charge. And he's, you know, he's very, very smart. He likes things to kind of, yeah. And that's, I think, is an addiction in some ways. An addiction that comes from trauma.
Yeah. But it's certainly trauma-related, put it that way.
Yeah. And this is another thing, is that addiction that is born from things beyond your control. So some people get addicted to their own pain medication.
Yeah.
People get addicted to certain modes of behaviour because of trauma that they've suffered or things that they've had to do. And that's really unfortunate, because then that's not a choice, is it?
No, I mean, there comes a point when you realise what's happened, that you have the choice to continue it or to fight it.
Yeah.
But certainly the initial stimuli, if you like, perhaps wasn't a choice.
Yes. So we've got that with Kaz. And then you have this Joda Parem. How it's pronounced?
Yeah.
Joda Parem, which is this stimulating drug, which it plays a significant part throughout the story. It's basically about this drug. I really, really liked that book.
Yeah.
I really liked it. I liked how real the characters were and how real it was diverse. It was interesting. It was multi-layered. And it was the first time I read a drug story, which was specifically about a drug and didn't felt sick for a very different kind of reason, you know?
Yeah, definitely. And I think that's the thing to remember, is that people who produce high-kicking drugs, if you like,
mm-hmm.
this is not people trying to make a quick buck or trying to get by. This is people very specifically targeting areas that are weak. And in some cases, it can be on a colonial level. I mean, think about the entire opium trade the British Empire had with China, for example, and India, and how that was part of control. So introducing a drug like that into an area where you can make sure... another way that it was done was the way that the Native Americans were introduced to certain forms of alcohol to create an addiction, because it's so much easier to control people who have an addiction.
Yes.
And addictions can be intergenerational and passed on because it's a habit of behaviour.
And if one thinks, again, the relationship between drugs and the underworld, addictions, the mafias, a lot of the criminal kind of classes really got in America during the Prohibition, because there was a demand for alcohol. And people wanted it, and people kind of needed it, and so where it was supplied, people took it. And ended up paying for things that ultimately are not necessarily very good.
Yeah.
And it's the same in this, in that there is this drug, there is this thing, and it doesn't matter actually what the consequences are on the large scale. There's a demand, because there's an addiction. And also, more specifically, not only is there a demand because there's an addiction, there's a demand because it offers this control over people.
Yeah.
And yeah. Expendable people.
Yeah, definitely. Right, just to round up, I'll just finish off and mention about Valiant by Holly Black, which is part of her urban fantasy fairy series. There you go, I said it. And it's really good. In Valiant particularly, Valerie is a girl, obviously, who... She comes home one day to find her boyfriend sleeping with her mother.
Awkward.
And she's so betrayed that she just gets on a train, goes into the city, and basically disappears. She finds a group of homeless kids, and they sort of take her on board. But one of the homeless kids has the sight, and he delivers certain medication for fairies that are forced to live Ironside, as they call it. Mm-hmm. Ironside is basically, if you have to live in a town or near where any of the pollutants and iron and things are, then you need medication in order to not slowly die of iron poisoning. So he delivers all this stuff. But they find out that if you take fairy medication and you're human, then for a few hours it gives you the ability to create glamours and do minor bits of magic. And it's incredibly addictive. And they start injecting it. And it's called Nevermore, or Never, because of the rules. It's like, never more than once in a day, never more than 3 days in a row, and some other rule. And it is so incredibly addictive that they start doing it all the time, and some really bad stuff happens. And it's not pretty. This could literally have been drawn from the life of someone who lives on the streets and does heroin on a regular basis.
Yeah.
But it is also a very, very good story, so I highly recommend that one.
There's a film coming out quite soon, which is about people literally stopping their own hearts for the rush.
The remake of Flatliners. I saw the original.
That's right. I've seen the original. How was that?
The original? I don't know. I think when I saw it, I just thought, this is stupid. Why are they doing this? Because I was a teenager when I saw it. I kind of understand the premise a little bit better now, but...
Mm.
It'll be interesting to see how they tackle it. In my opinion, it was a mediocre film, but I think nothing else quite like it had been done at the time, so that's why it was so popular.
I see. Okay.
But, you know, regularly killing yourself to get the rush of chemicals that you get from dying for a few seconds, because, as we've spoken before, your brain just goes, okay, you're dying, I'm going to make sure your passing is painless, and floods you full of opiates.
Well, I kind of got the impression in the new one that they develop some sort of abilities from it.
Maybe. They don't in the original.
And then that something starts coming for them.
Yeah. I think the thing is, in the original, it's made very clear that side of it is very much down to the fact that, you know, they're doing themselves damage. They're regularly killing themselves. And it's creating paranoia. And it... giving them slightly souped up senses, in the sense of, there's a theory that a sixth sense is really just the ability to use your five senses correctly and interpret the material they give you in one much more effectively than most people. And there's probably something to that. And perhaps dying on a regular basis. I mean, they've talked about people having had out-of-body experiences and near-death experiences, and they're not coming back psychic so much. What they're coming back is with the ability to really use their five senses and much more perceptive because of it. So I think that's what the original Flatliners sort of took on board.
Okay.
I don't know whether they've done it slightly differently and they can now shoot laser beams out their eyes or something in the new film.
Absolutely. They then join the Avengers, and that's that. Well, I think we've run out of time.
Yeah, that's us for this week.
Do get in contact with us. Have you read any books which deal with addiction? Did you like them? Did you not like them? Did you feel it could have been done differently? And we will catch you guys next week.
Yeah, thanks and goodbye.
Bye.
You've been listening to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast. You can follow our podcast at podbean.com or from iTunes. For more information, visit our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/dissectingreaders or check out our author websites at jaironside.com and madelinevaughan.com. Please note that no dragons were harmed during the making of this podcast.